time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Good news and bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Ah! See, a United States astro robot becomes a creature of death.
Oh. And Dave.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain! Back to the House of Pain!
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-movie podcast from Class the Cults and all the cheese in between. The movies are B, entertainment is grade A, and I'm your host, Mr. Jason Giaconetti, and this time out, I'm joined once again by my friend, Mr. Jonathan Inbody. Hey, Jonathan.
I'm back.
Yeah.
And I've brought a remake of a movie we covered on the show before, which, you know, I like a little less than the original, but I still really like.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about 13 Ghosts, the 2001 remake, and we'll get to it right after this.
There are ghosts around us all the time. Most of them, they can't hurt us. Most of them don't even want to hurt us. But there are exceptions.
Is it bad tonight?
Oh, bad? It's my professional opinion. We should get the hell out of here. Now.
I represent the estate of your Uncle Cyrus.
We have an Uncle Cyrus?
Cyrus recorded this message 6 weeks ago. He asked it to be played for you in the event of his death.
Arthur, I've instructed my lawyer to deliver my last will and testament.
A key?
A key to what?
A key to your new house. This house is the fruit of my life's work.
Oh my God.
It is a one-of-a-kind home.
It's marvelous, isn't it?
Wow!
Arthur, we've got some papers to sign in the library. After that, I would love to take you and the family around the tour of the house.
This place is awesome!
All right, now I know I'm dreaming.
Well, your uncle was quite a collector of many things.
What the hell was that?
This Halloween.
You're wasting your time. It's all sealed up.
The only thing worse than being trapped in a house with a ghost.
This house is not a house. We're in the middle of a machine. Powered by the dead.
Is being trapped in a house with 13 ghosts.
Maggie!
What?
We got company.
Where? I can't see.
How close is it?
Close enough to hurt you.
Go, 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 go!
Can I rely on you not to get me killed?
I guarantee you nothing.
13 Ghosts was released in the on October 26, 2001, with a 91-minute running time, and it had a budget of about $42 million with a box of about $68.5 million. Your distribution in the U.S. was done by Warner Brothers. It's a Dark Castle Entertainment. We'll talk more about Dark Castle Entertainment in a second. And your director is Steve Beck. Now, Steve Beck is well known for doing Ghost Ship, besides this one. That's this two notable works of these. Not exactly William Castle, but, you know.
Yeah, not the list of classics that you have listing William Castle movies.
I mean, Ghost Ship is pretty good. I mean, if you're going to be known for one, I'd rather be known for Ghost Ship than House of Wax, to be honest with you.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
So your producers here, of course, because it's it's Dark Castle, Robert Zemeckis, Joel Silver, Gilbert Adler. Your screenplay is Neil Marshall Stevens. It's funny, I saw Neil Marshall go, Neil Marshall. It's not Neil Marshall. It's not. Don't get your hopes up, folks. It's not the guy who gave us Descent and Dog Soldiers and stuff like that. And then Richard Diavidido. Your story is by Rob White, and it's based on, of course, the story by Rob White, 13 Ghosts, which is originally the original. So, but you said you're probably want to do a remake. I'm like, ooh, they're making a remake of Neon Maniacs?
Yeah, it's. I mean, it would be great if they did, but I think I might be the only one interested in making it. So I'm going to say right here on the air in front of God and everybody, if I remake Neon Maniacs someday, I'm going to come on the show to do it.
And we will have you
on. But for now, we got 13 Ghosts.
Yeah,
so.
I was thinking, like, ooh, what remake? And I was thinking, like, what movies have we done? I'm like, there's a Neon Maniacs remake? I don't know if you can better Neon Maniacs, because you would have a script or anything. Like, I think it just would be just random shooting stuff. Might be the only way to make a crazier film. So,
because making it coherent, like pulling it all together, might ruin the fun.
I think it does ruin the whole fun. Yeah. Anyway, so
13 Ghosts.
13 Ghosts. Yeah. Anyway. So Dark Castle Entertainment. Let's talk about Dark Castle for a second. So, I want to say it was around. It had to be 99. It was Joel Silver, Robert Zemeckis, and Gilbert Adler. They formed, they formed a division of Silver Pictures, which is Dark Castle Entertainment. And of course, it's named, you know, in homage to William Castle. I don't know how to even describe this. Their entire job was to make remakes. Like, it seems weird to say that, but it was, you know.
It feels like they all set out being like, oh, we all love these movies. Let's do modern, hip versions of these movies. And that largely was a huge failure.
Yeah, well, that's what they started off with. So their first movie was House on Haunted Hill, which the one that the William Malone directed remake, which was really good up until the end.
That movie falls apart really badly.
At the end, right? Yeah. The end of the movie, and then, sorry, folks, if you haven't seen it, here's a spoiler. The friggin' dust is the killer. I'm like, are you kidding? Like, not since The Happening. Has there been a dumber thing attacking at the end? I mean, you have all the creepy ghosts and all these monsters. I'm like, this is pretty good. This is good. What are they going to talk about so bad? I'm like, Chris Kattan's in it, but I can get past that, right? And you're like, oh, the dust, right? And I think that's what Dark Castle is known for. And in fact, the second movie they made was 13 Ghosts. In 2002, they made Ghost Ship. Ghost Ship has probably the best opening of any of their films, with the wire slicing every single person.
Yes. It's so good. This director really has a thing for people getting cut in half.
Yes. Steve Beck is the director of that as well. And then they did Gothica, which is the first non-remake they did. And that's the one with Halle Berry. And it features.
Oh, yeah. I forgot that was them.
Right. Yeah. It features a really good song. It was Behind These Eyes. It was Limp Bizkit. Mm-hmm. And who did it with them? I can't remember who was with them. And that song, but it's a really great song. It's totally not them, you know, kind of like, it's not like they're kind of like nookie and like, you know, whatever all the, good Lord, I can't think of, I know like 1,000 Limp Bizkit songs and I can't think of them right now, except for Nookie. But again, if you know your Limp Bizkit, you know, the rap core kind of stuff is not that. And then in 2005, they made House of Wax. House of Wax was probably their biggest misstep, I think they did. After that, you see them move away from the remakes. They did The Reaping and Return on House on Haunted Hill. And then Rock and Rolla, which was a Guy Ritchie film.
That movie is really good.
Yeah.
That movie is super solid. I like that movie a lot.
Which of these movies is not like the others? I
feel like very different than House of Wax, which is it's an embarrassing failure what they did with House of Wax. Yeah. Like, it's a real bummer to watch.
Right. It's not like, I mean, the thing is, especially considering Mysteries at a Wax Museum and then House of Wax being a remake of the original one from the 30s with Faye Wright. Mm-hmm. And House of Wax is such a good movie with Vincent Price. And you're watching it, you're like, what? Like, literally.
What did they do to this? Yeah,
they paid for the name and said, we're going to stick this on any piece of garbage we got and then stick it out there. So, but down the line, you look at, the thing is, they eventually made the movie Splice, which I like. That's the one with the alien girl.
Yes, that movie is crazy. That movie is great.
They made Whiteout, which was the one with
Is that the Kate Beckinsale in the Arctic one where she's like investigating a murder? Yeah. I don't think I ever saw that one actually.
It falls apart more at the end. It's really good, and you're like, oh, it's falling apart. I mean, they may have other ones on here. Orphan, which is not a bad one. Getaway, which Orphan's is a remake.
Pretty straight down the middle.
Yeah. Nothing. Oh my God. Ninja Assassin, which is again, an up totally different kind of movie.
Yeah, very much.
But the thing is, looking at a company here, they had, movies like House on a Hill, it winds up grossing almost 45 million. 13 Ghosts grosses almost 69 million. Ghost Ship, 69 million. Gothica, almost 142 million, kind of thing. And you look at these numbers and you're like, wow. And then so you realize when you get to House of Wax and House of Wax makes almost $69 million, people are like, oh, that wasn't so good. And then what happens, of course, is then their movies start falling off. I mean, I'm looking at the rest of them here. Ninja Assassin made almost 62, and Orphan made 78. But the other ones are all in the low 20s. In fact, Splice lost money, kind of thing. And I thought Splice might be the best movie they made of that kind of set. So, and again, this is not us, trying to rip apart Dark Castle, but I'm kind of giving some of our listeners might not know Dark Castle.
That's the thing. They have so many. It's a company that I think is defined by interesting failures or like almost successes.
Yes.
Because other than Rock and Rolla, which I genuinely think is a great movie, they didn't really make great movies. They made okay movies or bad movies that should have been good.
Yes. Yeah. And the problem is since they, but they were making horror movies. So a lot of that time, when you're investing 40 to make 70, that's a pretty good return on investment for a horror film. And they put them out at the right time. They're out in October. They were it's like before there was Saw, there were these movies coming out and we were making them. Every year there's one coming out. It's just you can't have a bomb. You can't have a movie that has, not that it didn't make money because that's what House of Wax did. It just was like, that was horrible.
It really soured everybody's opinions of those movies, like to the point that when I bring up this movie, 13 Ghosts, the remake, people will be like, oh, that's like the House of Wax. And they're like, no, it's not. It's better than that.
Yeah. And I think this is the main thing, if you think about it, for those of you who are Full Moon Entertainment fans, like Full Moon does not turn out like amazing pictures by way of like the best acting or the best special effects or the best whatever. And I'm not trying to knock the stuff they do, but they make a movie for a niche audience, right? Definitely. Especially nowadays. Good Lord. I mean, I can't imagine Evil Bong is exactly something like, but they make these movies for a reason. They make money, kind of thing. And they make their money the way they want to make it. They're not trying to compete with the blockbusters. They're not trying to compete with the Endgames and the, any kind of like other, PG-13 kind of movie. They're not trying to compete even with the hard R movies. They're not trying to compete with those things. They're trying to make their money through home video. I think Dark Castle was really saying, hey, we're a major player in this game and we want to be. And they could have been. And some of their movies are really good. And then they kind of fall apart at the end. I think we're going to hear this a lot. We said that with House on a Hill. I think it happens here. I think it happens in Ghost Ship. Like, it's just like they can't close, kind of thing.
That's going to be a big theme to this discussion of 13 Ghosts. Because the way I feel about it, like overall, is just kind of a preview of my specific thoughts on it is, so much of this movie works that the stuff that doesn't really stands out.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right. So your cast here, let me get to that. Here we go. So Tony Shalhoub, Monk it's so funny to me, Tony Shalhoub is always, Galaxy Quest, right? he's like, you never missed it. And he's just like, that was a hell of a thing, kind of thing. He's like, whatever, but everyone knows him as Monk. And then, you have, so, and then, I mean, M. Beth, Davids was, she has second billing, but really the second bill of this movie is Matthew Lillard. Everyone knows him from Scream. I know him more. I mean, I know him from Scream, obviously, but every time he talks, I'm like, okay, Shaggy, no problem. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, Shaggy.
That's what I think this whole movie.
Yeah. He's Shaggy and he is. And then, Shannon Elizabeth, who everyone knows, from American Pie. But, that's what it is. So, I think we all saw American Pie. And if you haven't seen American Pie, folks, come on. Like, really? 2019, catch up. And then, Rod Digga, she plays Maggie. She's a DJ, which is why she's cutting and scratching the movie. F. Murray Ray Abraham's here for a little bit and then a little bit.
Yes. And he chews the scenery. He's fantastic.
And then a whole bunch of other names no one probably cares about. The one guy is Ken Kurzinger is the station stunt performer. He put a lot of the stunts and stuff in there. So, of course, Ken Kurzinger would later go on to play Jason Voorhees in Freddy vs. Jason. Yes.
Right.
He is
yes.
the replacement for Kane Hodder because they felt Kane Hodder was too short to play Jason. And I'm like, he's a pretty big dude, but they wanted a really big, tall Jason. If you remember Jason vs. Freddy, Jason is humongous in that movie.
Yeah, he's a Hulk in that one.
It's just what it is. So, again, there's a bunch of people in here. I mean, and like you said, F. Murray Abraham, he chews the scenery. He's in it. He is just, he's only in the movie a little bit. But it makes sense what he does in there. And it's like, okay, but then they got a quality actor there. If it had been somebody who wasn't very good, you'd be like, oh God, please just kill him. Just kill him. You know,
yeah. And it's his energy really carries the like opening and ending of the film.
Yeah.
And then, Dennis, Matthew Lillard pretty much carries he keeps you interested. He's very charming. He's very fun in this movie. And he really kind of makes up for any of the other acting missteps in the middle part of the movie.
Yeah. Well, I think what they were trying to do was they were trying to be hip, hip and edgy for the kids. And they kind of misread what hip and edgy was supposed to be. Because I'm not trying to be mean to Shannon Elizabeth because she's a lovely woman. But she's lovely for other reasons in American Pie. So I'm just saying. she's very easy on the eyes, but we weren't there going, wow, she's good. She should do Shakespeare. No.
Yeah, that is kind of the problem overall with this is it's so very like you can see the producers as you're watching the movie where it's like they'll like make a choice and you'll be like, oh, that was a studio note.
Yes.
Like somebody was like, oh, you know what we need though? We need like a DJ character. She can be their housekeeper and she can be sassy. And it's like, we don't need this character, right? Like we can just, you could write around her pretty easily.
Yeah. I mean, she could not been in the whole movie and would have been not have been a problem. In fact, I'll get there at the end because, there's always the, why does this person survive? Why does that person survive? She's on that list of, oh, she's going to die. Oh, what do you mean she's not dead yet? Why is she not dead yet? You know, kind of, like sometimes you meet people in a movie, you're like, oh, that guy's going to die. Oh,
yeah, for sure.
Like, okay, red shirt, you're going to die. You know, kind of thing. Yeah. Like you're there to go with Spock and Bones and, Kirk to go down to the planet because someone needs to get vaporized, and you're like, and they lived. So anyway, all right. So let's get started on this thing here. So our story opens with Ghost Hunter, Cyrus Crickados. That's F. Murray Abraham. And his psychic assistant, Dennis Rafkin, and that's Matthew Lillard, and they lead a team on a mission to capture a spirit called the Juggernaut. And of course, the movie opens, they're in the junkyard and stuff like that. It's really cool, kind of like...
It's very Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yes.
Is it 4 or 5? Which one of those
three.
Is the...
No.
3? Right, because then it comes back in 4. Yeah.
It's the end of 3, beginning of 4. That's when beginning of the 4 when the dog pees the fire and and that's when Kincaid is like, Fred is back, Fred is back. For those of you interested in hearing Nightmare on Elm Street, check out the Vault on the network where we covered all the Nightmare on Elm Street movies in a lot of vulgarity and craziness because that's what we do on that show, kind of thing. Family friendly here, Vault, not so much.
It's wonderful.
Oh man, we do our thing on that show. So several men, including apparently Cyrus, are killed while the team is able to catch the ghost. And it's kind of nuts. You're like, how are they going to, like, this thing is like, he's coming and he's slaughtering everybody. And there's a glass box. It's like, I love how nothing's fully explained in the beginning. I like how they do that instead of like nowadays, again, this is only 18 years ago, but I think nowadays it'd be like, oh, we have to get him in the box. Why? Cause that's how we have it. And they'd have to like explain it all to me because I can't be confused for 5 freaking seconds,
Yeah. That's the thing that I like. A lot of the design stuff and the world stuff for this movie works really well and dropping you into it. And then having everybody like, everyone has a shared language, all the ghost hunter people in this movie, like they'll talk about like containment spells. They talk about the box, and they talk about stuff in a way that's clear that they know what's going on. But as the audience, it's not that you're like confused, you're not left out, but you just go like, oh, that's interesting. Whatever this is, I'm going to learn about that eventually.
Right. Yeah.
Like it has a really good feel to it where it doesn't feel cheap.
Yeah, it's kind of like remember we talked about Phantasm, how that whole world, sometimes there's things going on and you're like, wait, okay. Like they, like, okay. Oh, I get it now. Like you're supposed to be confused. Like, not confused, but you're supposed to be, like, you're not supposed to have all the knowledge to start off.
Yeah, you're supposed to be interested.
Yeah, right. And I feel that's what happens. And I think that's why this movie has a good hook. I mean, you get in, there's violence and blood and gore. I mean, if you didn't think this movie was R to start with, here it is, folks, 5 minutes in, we've slaughtered a whole bunch of people, you know.
Yeah, that guy gets folded in half into a car trunk. That's, like, the best stunt in this whole movie. I love that scene so much.
There's a pretty good one coming up with the lawyer that I love, too.
That's true. Actually, as far as gags go, that one's pretty – that's hard to beat.
That's a very William Castle gag. So, all right. So Cyrus's nephew, Arthur, which is Tony Shalhoub, he's a widower. His obviously, they see it in the flashback here. We see that his wife has died in a house fire, and she's burned a lot – or she's burned. She doesn't die in the house fire. She dies of the house fire. She dies she's severely burned trying to save the children, and he's riddled with guilt.
Which also, if I can just say, this the little opening credits, like they do, it's like trying to imitate like a one shot where it just pans around the living room of the house, like from the kids playing in the window, pans around. It eventually becomes the like crappy apartment that they live in now, and it comes back around to Tony Shalhoub being like super depressed. That shot is so good. Like, it's really great. It's on a whole nother level cinematography-wise from anything else in this movie.
Right. And that's what I'm saying is things are like, huh. Like, so you wonder sometimes if you could take the studio, like, if you take their fingerprints off a movie, what would it look like? You know, kind of thing. Yeah. You could just take away the, like, oh, you guys meant well, but no, not so much, you know, kind of thing. So.
Yeah, and it still wouldn't be perfect because, like, even the cinematography in this movie feels very, like, early 2000s, where there's, like, a lot of jarring cuts. There's a lot of, like, weird close-ups all of a sudden. Like, there's a slow-mo that doesn't really belong where it is. So it's, like, that kind of stuff still would be distracting, but if it was just that and not all these weird, like, story choices that kind of mount as the movie goes on, I feel like it would be a significantly better film already.
Yeah, I think that because you could see that there's stuff that's good there.
And then definitely.
But if you took out the nonsense that didn't need to be there, you could accept, okay, we probably don't need this in slow-mo. Okay, we probably don't, you know, whatever. But like, those become nitpicks instead of like,
Stylistic stuff.
Yeah, again, someone else's, it's their vision of what they want to put out there compared to, I don't think that's what's in the script. Like, okay, this is out of left field, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, compared to one more symptom of clearly the producers being like, oh man, the kids are going to love this.
Yeah, right. So, we meet Arthur and we meet his children. And what happened, which is Bobby and Kathy. Kathy, of course, is Shannon Elizabeth. Bobby is Alec Roberts. And then we meet their nanny, who is Maggie, who doesn't do a whole lot of anything.
Literally nothing. Really doesn't nothing. Cook. Doesn't clean.
She doesn't take care of Bobby. She's horrible.
No.
And that's Rod. Her name is her stage name is Rod Digger. She's a DJ. She's a very famous DJ for when I'm gathering. I've never heard of her. I have to just heard her name. You got to be kind of careful saying it in a family friendly show. that's when we meet the informed by the Cyrus estate lawyer, Ben Moss. Little nod there to the original, of course.
And I like that they cast a guy who looks like a Fink, who looks like he might be up to something.
Yeah.
Cause it makes your expectations go a certain way for a bit, which is nice.
Yeah. But he's all like, everything. He's like, oh, I don't want to touch this. I don't want like, hate being there. And that's J.R. Bourne. And then he informs them that they inherited Cyrus's mansion. And of course, Arthur, after the fire, his entire life is ruined. So he's financially insecure. He decides to move everybody to the mansion. So, and they drive up there. So that's the scene where they're driving. And of course, Maggie, like literally Shannon Elizabeth is the adult in this. And I'm assuming Maggie's supposed to be older than her, but if you didn't know better, you would think Maggie's just some child they found in the street and brought along for the ride.
They don't do a good job of showing why Maggie's there at all. Cause like Arthur in the first scene with Maggie, like basically the introduction to her character is Arthur being like, hey, can you do a thing that I expect you to do as your employer? And she's like, no. And he's like, oh, okay.
Yeah. I totally feel like this would be like, okay. So nowadays, and I don't mean to get all crazy, but, oh, Jay, like nowadays, Maggie and Kathy would be lovers or something like that. that's how it would explain how
I mean,
there.
That'd be at least doing something with the characters.
No, but,
like,
that, but that's, how they, that's how they explain she's there. Because she, she wouldn't expect her to be the nanny. She's, you know, she's kind of the love interest, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, and
or,
there's
or
a weird thing, too.
Love interest.
Yeah. There is a weird thing, too, that they're like, okay, we're going to put, like, a hip black DJ character in here. She'll be the housekeeper. Where I'm like, oh, guys, this is not better.
Right. Yeah.
Like, guys, don't do that.
You're not helping yourselves here, guys.
No, not at all.
They're in the hole. They're like, dig up, stupid, up. There's TV thinking that. So, anyway, all right. So, posing. Okay, so they get to the house, which is insane. Glass.
Oh, the set design is beautiful.
I mean, I think that's what this, that's what I'm saying is you look at it, you're like, oh man, like this has the makings of being a really well remembered movie, and
absolutely.
As it is, you know, it, that's there. I mean, everything's there. It's just that you need a little spit and polish here, some cuts here and there, and then like you could tighten this thing up. I mean, it's a 91 minute running time. I'm not saying cut this thing to 78 minutes. What I'm saying is a little spit and polish and tightening things up here and maybe getting rid of some elements that don't make sense. You already got a really good film that could be like memorable. You know?
Yeah, it's the script problem, like that just extends to every other part of it. Because if the script was a little bit more clear, a little bit better, the characters had a little more to do, the ones that are underused, like it would, it really could go from like you know a 6 to like an 8 or a 9 quality wise really easily, but they just didn't, you know?
Because the effects are knockouts in this whole film.
Yeah, absolutely. So, all the design work in this movie is brilliant. Like the makeup design, the set design, everything looks so cool.
Yeah. So we have posing as a power company inspector, Dennis, and that's, you know, good old Shaggy coming back here, meets the family and Moss as they tour the mansion. So they go into that crazy doors that open and you're like, he puts the key in. And it's like, I mean, the whole clock, I mean, the whole house it appears to be a giant clock. How no one sees this, I don't get, because it's all see-through, but okay.
Yeah, they all really accept that the walls are all see-through glass, like, immediately. Like, they say one thing about it, but everyone's like, I guess this is fine.
Yeah. Like, so, you know, obviously, like, everything's made of glass and has inscribed with Latin phrases. You know, obviously, Dennis recognizes them as barrier spells because he knows all this stuff, but he doesn't let on to this because he's supposed to be, you know, an electric company guy, not a ghost hunter. So he, you know, so he starts searching the basement, and that's where Dennis is hit by the psychic flash and discovers that the 12 ghosts, well, it's not 12, there's 12 ghosts.
Well, there are
captured,
12, yeah.
12
but...
captured.
Yeah, because earlier at the opening scene, they do a really nice piece of setup where the like ghost rights people that kind of come back later on in the movie are like yelling at Cyrus and they're like, you'll never get the 13th ghost.
Right.
And Dennis is like, I was contracted for 12. I'm not getting involved in this. What is up? Like, what's going on here?
Exactly.
And Cyrus is like, it's not important. Don't worry about it.
Right. Yeah. That's a plot hole we got to cover later.
Yeah, exactly.
So he gets hit with all this. And then, so we now really understand, obviously, that Dennis gets psychic flashes. And you start seeing the 12 ghosts and, that he and Cyrus have captured, and now Cyrus has imprisoned them in the house, and he's held them in place with spells. And of course, you know, as you start learning about that, the thing is they don't ever tell you all about the ghosts. I mean, I have a whole bit about that after, about each one of them.
They have
stuff like that.
All these great backstories that never get used in the movie.
Yeah, they don't tell you them. I mean, the only one you know this backstory on is the wife a little bit, and that's very, very minimal. So Dennis goes to try to warn Arthur. And what happens, that's when Moss and him start arguing, but Moss slips downstairs and picks up a valise full of cash, which then triggers a mechanism that seals the entire house and releases the ghost one by one. So here's the thing is, like, once you've seen this movie the first time, watching it the second time, knowing how the end is going to happen, you're like, oh my God, this is completely a setup. Everything's a setup.
Oh yeah. Everything's
a setup. You can see all the setups. You're like, oh.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like, and again, folks, it's 2019. If you haven't seen Usual Suspects, come on, right?
Yeah,
it's like,
spoilers.
Right, sorry. Right, if you haven't seen, like, one of the best movies ever made, period. And when you watch Usual Suspects the second time, you're like, holy shit, holy stuff. Oh, I kind of swear there. sorry, folks. He looks around the whole office.
Yeah, you can see his eyes move to the different stuff that he's going to use later. Like, really good.
Yeah. So, So again, when you know what's happening here, so he sets the whole house in motion. And now, I mean, it's bad enough the things where he's spinning in the middle of the whole house appears at the middle of it spinning, and now other things are spinning. And you're like, does no one notice this? I mean, literally, you can see
everything. It's a lot, too. Yeah. They're like a big spinning machine in the middle of the house.
It's not tiny. Everything's spinning. Yeah. So, where are we? So that's when, what do you call it? The woman, when she's released now, and he's, cause he.
Oh, yes. The, what is it? The something beauty or the with, let's see.
Find her name. Sorry. For the first board, horse.
The Angry Princess. That's
the Angry Princess. Yes. Mm-hmm. So Dana Newton was a beautiful but abused lady who lived in the late 1900s. She had plastic surgery to alter her perceived flaws, and after a botched experiment that mutated her eyes, she brutally killed herself in a bathtub at the clinic. Her ghost often carries blood, is naked, and carries the same knife she used to commit suicide. That is her backstory. And so he's backing up, and that's when the doors close and slice him, like, not in half in the middle, like, but like cut him into two equal parts, just right through the back of the skull, you know. And the best part is he slides down and the other part sticks a little bit, so the back slides down, and I'm like,
I love the way that they do that gag. It's so good.
Yeah.
Which, and it also sets up, like, one of two pretty good jokes in this movie. Where later on, a scene just ends with Maggie going, "Did the lawyer split?"
Yeah,
just wonderful.
Well,
and then
later she then goes, "Is that the lawyer?" Like, yeah, you know, like as if you forgot that he's now laying, his corpse is laying on the ground as they're running around. So,
which the other good joke in this movie that happens earlier when Dennis is talking to Arthur and trying to explain to him that he and Cyrus caught ghosts, and Arthur just stops for a second, and there's like a couple seconds of a pause, and then Arthur's like, "Goats?" And it's so stupid that it makes me laugh every time.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my God. Okay, so the sliding door slides shut, cutting him in half. So Bobby slips away from Kathy and Maggie. All right, so upstairs, Kathy's in what she wants to be her room. She's looking at the bathroom. Maggie is supposed to be, she's running around with Bobby, but she's really bad at keeping track of him because she's really bad at her job.
She's just a terrible housekeeper. She really is.
Or nanny or whatever she's supposed to be. She's bad at pretty much everything.
Yeah, I mean, definitely.
She's good at being a mooch. I guess that's about it. But, you know, kind of thing. Because she's like mooching off of them. But, like, she's not good at anything else. And, again, they pay her. That's what gets me. So Bobby slips away and he enters the basement. And as he's going down the stairs... where we see several of the you see the withered lover, it's his mother, and she's telling him, "Don't come down the stairs, go back." Like, and he's like, kind of like looking around, and he stops, he's looking. I wondered at one point, he's like, "Mom?" Like, that would be like the most on that head thing to say. Like, you kind of figure it must be his mom, but like, nowadays, he'd have to say that. Mom?
Yeah, definitely.
You know, like,
that's Mom, is that you?
Like, yeah. Mom? Oh my God. You know, like, okay. Right? And of course, so he's knocked unconscious and dragged away. Now he had the glasses on, so he can kind of see things, right? Now we talked about this when we talked about 13 Ghosts Original, the spectral viewers there, you know, those special glasses and stuff. Here they actually make it a big part of the movie. Like, you need these to see the ghost.
Yeah,
you know,
which I really like.
Yeah.
They do a lot of cool stuff with it as the movie goes on into, like, everybody's trapped looking for each other, trying to get out. Like, they do some fun little gags with one character being able to see the ghosts and other characters who can't see the ghosts having to, like, listen to them when they say to duck or to run or to whatever.
Well, that's when we get the scene, too, upstairs where, you know, now the glasses are on the sink or on the thing, and they go through the glass. So now what you're seeing is through the glass, and you see Kathy in the bathroom, and they go through the glass. The whole bathroom's covered in blood, and there's all the writings all over the place. And she runs the water, and there's the tortured princess in the bathtub full of blood, but it looks like it's water to her. And it's like, it's just so crazy. Like, you're like,
yeah, it's really cool.
Like, that is weird to see. It's really cool, but it's really weird. You're like, whoa, okay. Like, someone thought about that. Someone really thought about the idea that we should really kind of, you know, make this look cool like this. This shouldn't be, you know.
And to play with the idea that the ghosts are invisible unless you have the viewers, you know?
And it's
a really nice device.
Well, I also like the fact that the ghosts can hurt you, even if you can't see them. But if you don't, she's got the water running in her hand, and the water is now blood through the viewer, but it's not blood on her. It's just water. But like the ghost is seeing it this way, and that if she had reared back and stabbed her, it would have hurt her. And like it's all these things that you could happen. You're still learning this though as you're going. Mm-hmm. So they use a pair of spectral glasses that allows the wearer to see into the supernatural realm. Dennis convinces Maggie that the ghosts are real. Dennis discovers that the jackal, one of the most dangerous of the 12 ghosts, has been released, and the family is now in grave danger. Let's talk about the jackal for a second.
Oh, so
he's
cool.
He's pretty dang cool.
Love
the
it.
The jackal. There you go. Born to a prostitute in 1887, Ryan Coon developed a sick appetite for women, attacking, raping strays and prostitutes in the night. Very upbeat story here.
He voluntarily, so pleasant.
He voluntarily went to Bornhamwood Institute for treatment to cure his problem, but the medical practices made him much worse, causing him to go completely insane. After years of solitary confinement, he developed a hatred of humanity. After facing the flames, his ghost carries his torn straitjacket with a cubicle head brace that is called, it's called a sign of hell's winter. So that's the second ghost, and he's like the Wolverine of ghosts. You know, kind of thing.
He is
like,
incredibly scary and weird.
I mean, he's and so the jackal attacks Kathy, and he's tearing her apart. I mean, mm-hmm. her back's getting all ripped apart. He's like berserker raging on her, like, you know, from the old Capcom games. and when Arthur enters basement to search for Bobby, but they wind up being saved by Kalina. Now Kalina is one of those the spiritual rights people from the beginning,
yes.
You know, kind of thing. And that's M. Beth Davids. She comes in, and her whole thing is just like she uses those flares, which they make fun of, and they're like, that doesn't work.
Yeah, like Quicksilver flares or something. Yeah. Like there's so much good techno babble in this movie, and all over the place.
It's weird stuff too. You're like, okay,
yeah.
Like how does that work? But you don't have to know how it works. You have to know it does work.
You can tell they thought of how it works.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
So you don't need to know, but you know that they actually care about the rules.
Yeah. So, I mean, she's one of the spirit limiters. Now she's coming to free the ghost. Mm-hmm. Kathy then disappears. And the four adults gather in the library where Arthur learns that Jean's ghost is trapped in the house. Now real quick, Jean, of course, is the withered lover. Jean Krikatos was a happy and devoted wife and mother. She dies as a result of a fire injuries at St. Luke's Hospital half a year before the events of the film. Unlike most of the ghosts, she is not dangerous. She is benevolent. And she's the only benevolent one in the whole film. Because is there anyone who's benevolent in the other original? I don't think so.
Yeah, not really, no.
They're all pretty crazy. Like,
yeah. Yeah, the original, they're much more, they act like very much haunted house ghosts where they're just kind of messing around.
Yeah.
Like, they just like scaring people.
Yeah. Well, they'll kill you. It's not that. Yeah. It's just that they're like, eh, this, like there's not one who's like, oh, let me help them. It's like, eh, yeah. Nope.
No.
No. Mr. Griffin, no home. No. Anyway. Okay, so they're trapped in the house. I don't know. Okay. Kalina explains that the house is a machine powered by the captive ghosts, and they can allow the user to see part the past, the present, and the future. And because knowledge is power, so the most powerful man in the world is that who has all knowledge. And I'm like, okay.
There's so much.
Yeah,
that whole scene is so much. Like she's like, okay, here's the Necronomicon. It's called the Arcanum.
Right.
Cyrus is building Basilius's device, and it needs the Black Zodiac, and it'll open the Ocularis Infernum. And you're like, wow, this is like a lot, huh? Yeah. Is there gonna be a test?
Yeah, is this all gonna be on the final? Because it's like literally, it's like she hits them with a whole lot
it's
of stuff.
A lot.
Yeah, a whole lot of stuff. The only way to shut it down, she says, is through the creation of a 13th ghost from a sacrifice of pure love. Arthur realizes that he must become the ghost by dying to save his children.
I like that device a lot in the story. I like the idea of the last one being, because like all these people have died in all these horrible different ways, but I like the last one being defined by somebody who dies for the sake of somebody else. Like that's a really cool plot device for this.
I think it's a good idea. I think just that scene is so much.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You're like, what? Like, at one point, I went to Maggie and be like, what? You know, kind of thing that she can't follow. I mean,
like nothing in that scene, too.
Well, she shouldn't because she's just like, it's crazy white people talking about, kind of thing. You know? Just saying.
She's just like, look, I just work here. Yeah, I don't want any part of this.
Ah, quit! You know, kind of thing. And
which literally does happen at the end.
Her last line of the movie. So
that like really bums me out that they ended on that note of like, hey, we'll just cut to a comic relief character and have her quit, and that'll be fine.
Yeah, I think that definitely feels like an add-on.
It's just so lazy. It's man. Well, we'll get there.
Yeah. So they arm themselves with a pane of the glass that has the writing on it, which I think is a really cool idea. It's like
great.
The shield. It's like having Captain America's shield, right? Mm-hmm. And Arthur and Dennis enter the basement. That's when Dennis and Enter get together. They become dentists. Dennis and Arthur enter the basement to find the children. At one point now, they're using the barrier against the ghost. They can't get through it. Dennis barricades Arthur into a corner behind the glass, protecting Arthur, but allowing two ghosts, who is the Hammer and the Juggernaut, to beat Dennis to death. Let's talk about...
The Hammer is so cool.
The Hammer
is the coolest dude.
So, here we go. The Hammer. Then we'll do the Juggernaut. A happy and honest family man, George Markle, was falsely accused of stealing by a higher-up named Nathan, and threatened with exile from the old western town. George refused to leave, and his family was killed by Nathan and his band of thugs while walking home from the town market one day. Seeking justice in the corrupt town, George took his blacksmith's hammer and killed those responsible, but the townsfolk chained him to a tree and drove railroad spikes into his body. His left hand was cut off, and a hammer was crudely attached to it. His ghost is one of the more angry spirits and particularly responsible for Dennis' death. And then you have the Juggernaut, whose name is Horace Breaker Mahoney.
Great name.
Just Horace Pinker, which was from Shocker kind of thing. It made me think of that immediately. Just saying. So Horace Breaker Mahoney was born very disfigured and was an outcast his entire life. His mother abandoned him at a tender age, and his father put him to work in the junkyard, using his unusual strength to crush cars. After his dad died, Horace went insane. He would take motorists and hitchhikers, tear them apart with his bare hands, and feed the remains to his dogs.
You know, like you do.
Very, very upbeat here. That's
typical stuff. Yeah.
After several of these murders, he was arrested. A SWAT team shot and killed him when he broke free of his handcuffs. As a ghost, he remained at the junkyard, killing intruders. Both Dennis and Cyrus remarked that his kill count numbered in the 40s, making this ghost one of the most evil and dangerous of the 12.
I feel like I know that they have to fill 13 ghosts, but I feel like the Hammer and the Juggernaut are so much the same type of character.
Yeah.
That if it weren't called 13 ghosts, they could have combined the characters and made it really compelling.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's cool. I think it worked really well as a tag team.
Yeah. Definitely. Kind of it's just one of those things where I'm like, yeah, but it could have been one big scary ghost, like instead of two big scary ghosts.
Right. I agree.
And the hammer just looks so visually interesting with all the spikes in him and the hammer hand. Like, I just want like more of that guy. He's so cool.
Yeah. The problem is this movie, it shows you the ghost here and there, what it needs to do and stuff. But I feel like they're the best part of the whole movie is because they're super, super interesting. These ghosts.
Yeah. Like, but they get treated they get treated like set design and like more than characters, which is kind of a bummer.
Yeah. Where were we?
So like the torso is a guy wrapped in cellophane and cut into pieces. And he's like barely in the movie. He's in like two shots.
Yeah. Okay. So, and this is when this is when Arthur realizes that obviously his wife is one of the spirits trapped in the house kind of thing. She comes to him and stuff like that. And then she's taken away and Arthur's like, well, I'll give up my life to save them because he's trying to save her. Mm-hmm. Let's just talk about people. So we left because we're going to wind up running out of time to talk about these ghosts. So
yes,
there's the firstborn son, a ghost of a little bratty boy named Billy Michaels who loved to pretend to be a cowboy. One day, another little kid challenged him to a duel, but the boy's cap gun was no match for a real life steel tipped arrow. Billy's ghost still carries. Unlike most of the ghosts, he is a mild threat, never attacking anyone, but just saying, "I want to play." That's the one who's luring Bobby down to the basement.
Yeah, he's another one I wish they would do a little more with, because he's like my whole thing with this movie. Like, I like so many of the ghost designs, but I feel like they just need to take it a little more broad with the like appearances of the ghosts. Like, they have the cowboy kid, they have the guy who's like the hammer. Like, some of these other ones are just a little bit less gimmick driven than some of the others, and the gimmick driven ones are so interesting.
Right.
Like, I just want them to be a really heavy gimmick. You know, like, I wanted to take it to, like, a Scooby-Doo level gimmick place with these characters.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you have Shaggy already, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and you have the person who gets killed off, but they let her live. So we have the torso, who's Jimmy the Gambler Gambino. I think that's insulting just being Italian. was a gambler in the early 1900s who caught the attention of the mafia. After he lost a boxing bet, the mafia cut him into pieces and wrapped him in cellophane, dumping the remains in the ocean. His ghost appears as a torso with a severed head nearby and is more a neutral spirit than an active hostile. The Bound Woman. Susan LeGros was the richest girl in town and was very popular. Her one flaw was that she toyed with boys and men. During her senior prom night, she was killed by a jilted ex named Chet Walters, a star quarterback. Her ghost lures Bobby into the dangerous basement and still shows bound rope holding her arms. Well, the thing is, she does that, but it's also, what do you call it? She's calling him, but the little boy's like, let's play. Like, as you hear that too. So
I feel like they set themselves up in a place where, like, I get, again, it's 13 ghosts. You got to have 13 ghosts.
Yeah.
But you can tell when they're writing the script, they already had the ghosts and they were like, okay, who can be the ghost that'll draw the kid down?
Yeah.
Okay, the ghosts that don't do anything later. So we'll just make it, you know, we'll make it the kid, we'll make it the bound woman. Like, you can tell that they're kind of scrambling for stuff to have the ghost do.
Right. Yeah. It's like, who didn't get any screen time yet? All right, let's put them on there. Yeah. So.
Yeah, we'll do one shot of the torso. We'll do one shot of the bound woman.
Yeah. Then you have the Torn Prince. Royce Clayton was a gifted and famous teenage baseball player in the 40s and 50s. Caught the eye of colleges around the U.S. Thanks to his challenger, a greaser, who set him up, Royce died in an accident caused by cutting his brake lines. His remains are still buried at the baseball diamond, and his ghost carries a baseball bat. He's the one who beats up when Dennis is caught in the room, and he can't see him, and he's getting wailed with the baseball bat. Like, so
That scene's fun, too.
Yeah, that's what you're talking about. With it. One person has the glasses, and one person doesn't, and
And she's telling him to duck and when to dodge and all that, like, which is, I like that business a lot, because they do that throughout all the, like, ghost encounter scenes, because there's the one set of glasses and there's like four people. So it's really nice that they actually, like, use that to their advantage and use the concept of the ghost viewers to their advantage in the scripting.
The Pilgrimess. Isabel Smith came to North America as a colonist in order to find a new life after being an orphan in England. The tight-knit community ostracized and ignored her and used her as a scapegoat, calling her a witch when crops and animals mysteriously died. She denied such accusations, but she was trapped in a burning barn and somehow remained unharmed. That sealed her fate, and she died of starvation, condemning to the pillory that she carries with her as a ghost. Her skin is badly damaged. Very little. She's not used very much here. You see her, but you don't use much.
Yeah, and she's another gimmick-driven one where I'm like, just give me a little more. Like, just show me the Puritan-style costume. Like, do a little bit with it.
Yeah. And the last two are always together. That's The Great Child and The Dire Mother. The Great Child, Harold Shelburne, was a special needs man who never outgrew diapers and had to be spoon-fed. Even as a fully grown adult, he often made baby sounds. After being mocked and teased and tormented relentlessly in his life, he caused a massacre at the old freak show, where he and his mother, Margaret Shelburne, lived. Some of the freaks had kidnapped and killed his mother as a joke one night. That's a joke?
As a joke, like you do.
You know, that's just Tuesday. The circus owner, Jimbo, had Harold mutilated beyond recognition. His ghost appears as Harold did in life, with a small patch of hair, a bib covered in vomit, and cloth diapers. He still holds the axe that he used to kill his enemies. The Dire Mother. Margaret Shelburne, Harold's mother, was a shy little lady standing 3 feet tall. She could, she never could stand up for herself as a freak show where she lived. She was raped by the tall man, another circus freak, and gave birth to
The people who wrote this backstory really hate circus folk, don't they?
They do.
Like, wow.
Wow.
It's a lot.
Notice, we didn't write this, folks. Just to let you know. Like, this, I'm just reading what's part of the...
Yeah, all the puns features. About her being a midget, that's not us.
Yeah, like, that's not us saying that.
Don't send us your hate mail. Yeah. Send it to Dark Castle.
Go track down whoever's left from Dark Castle. Joel Silver's still around, isn't he?
And Zemeckis is... I mean, he's, you know, he's not in a great place career-wise, but, you know.
But he's still... He's still can. Oh, people still watch my stuff.
Did anyone Gremlins? Watch Welcome to Marwen?
Oh, God. where are we? She gave birth to her illegitimate son, Harold, who she loved more than life itself. She smothered and spoiled him from infancy and never stopped as he grew. This is the main reason Harold's mentally handicapped. The two were abused to a point where Harold killed most of the entire circus as Margaret died. As ghosts, they remained together, with Harold being protective like the torso. She is not aggressive. Okay. Well, yeah, because she's not given anything to do. That's why she's not aggressive. Anyway. So
that's the thing. Like, if I'm doing because a dream project for me as a filmmaker would be to do another 13 ghosts. And if I did, one of the things I would do is make sure that there's a need for each of the ghosts to be there. Like, they need each, like, a scene where they're featured. They need something to do. They need, it needs to be clear what their gimmick is. Like, you know, give them some color, give them some interesting stuff on each of them, instead of just like, well, there's like five cool ghosts and then there's a bunch of other ones that just kind of are around.
Yeah. Cause we got to get 12. So, yeah. All right. So at this point we now as revealed that Cyrus faked his death to lure Arthur to the house, where Kalina is his secret partner. So Kalina and Maggie, they're into the room, going to try to stop the machine. That's when Kalina Colcocks Maggie in the back of the skull. Knocking her out with the book, which is kind of like a big swerve. You're like, what's going on here? You're like,
yeah,
oh, wait,
the
like,
stuff with Kalina never really fully makes sense.
It never does.
Like, because why, if she's a ghost rights activist, why would she be working with Cyrus?
Yeah.
And if she was always working with Cyrus and was undercover as a ghost rights activist, why did she try to stop Cyrus from catching the breaker at the beginning?
Yeah.
Or the juggernaut or whatever.
The juggernaut.
Yeah.
I don't know.
None of it makes sense.
Yeah, it's one of those plot holes. They're like, no one will notice that.
Yeah.
Truck through it. The Giants wish they old open holes that big. Good Lord.
Well, and I think in an early version of the script, Maggie was supposed to be the traitor. I think I read that somewhere, which at least would give Maggie something to do.
Well, that explains why she'd be there.
Yeah, like I would kind of like that better.
Yeah. Well, if they went in there and Maggie knocked out Kalina. And you're like,
yeah,
oh,
that'd be crazy. That'd be
that
quite a sense. Twist.
Yeah. What a twist. You know? Oh, my God. Anyways, Cyrus has orchestrated the abduction of Kathy and Bobby, so Arthur will become the 13th ghost, which will not stop the machine, as Kalina has claimed, but trigger its activation. Big swerve. Cyrus kills Kalina and summons the ghost to activate the machine. Okay. So she's like, but I did everything you said. I didn't, like, where all of a sudden she goes from being this strong, independent woman to being but I did what you said to do. And it's like, oh my God, really? Like, is it two characters you wrote together here?
Like, it really does feel like they just went, and now it's Kalina. Like, now she's this character. It's so lazy. It's such a lazy turn just to set up the climax.
Because I'll tell you right now, if you had that point where Kalina gets knocked out and Maggie's then Maggie's like, but I did what you wanted, because she's like a total lemming. You're like, okay, we totally get this. Like, you know,
sure.
She's done nothing the entire movie. You know,
yeah,
like,
and
she's
and
undercover
they've established
lazy. You
they've
know?
Established that Maggie would take like money, so they could have it be a thing where it's like, look, I did what you asked. Like, where's my money? I'll take off. Like, right. You know, there's a way to do that scene that isn't this.
Yeah. All right. So Arthur arrives at the main hall and witnesses all 12 ghosts orbiting the clock-like device, rotating.
Super cool shot.
Yeah. It screams 2001, though, the way the effects look.
Good. When they have the sequence of Arthur counting the ghosts one by one, and then it does all the weird extreme shots of them, that does not work at all. But there's a great wide shot of it rotating with all the ghosts standing there, and that shot, I wish they would have just held on that for a while.
See, I think what they were trying to go for is like the Sam Raimi. You know, like from Evil Dead, where he would, and now he's put it in like every movie he's ever made, where you kind of close up, you know, kind of thing. It's like, we got it, buddy. Like, you know, don't remind us of better directors.
Yeah, certainly. That's not going to help your movie. Yeah.
You're not helping anybody. So he discovers Cyrus's true fate. Okay, with the children in the middle, right? So that's when Arthur says, there's only 12 ghosts. Like, he literally, like, he didn't need to say it. Like, he actually says it. There's only 12 ghosts. And that's when he rushes Cyrus. You're like, dude, I mean, like, I get it, but you didn't have to say it. I'm like, all he needs to be like, wait a minute.
Oh. Yeah, I like the way that they show the audience that Cyrus is not a ghost, where Arthur figures it out, and he looks at Cyrus, and he takes the glasses off, and you see Cyrus still standing there once the glasses are off. That's really cool, but they could have just done that. Yeah, they didn't need the, like, let me count all the ghosts. Wait a minute, there's an extra ghost here. Yeah.
There's too many. I'm supposed to be number 13. Come on. Of course, discovering Cyrus's true fate, Arthur fights Cyrus while Maggie disrupts the machine's control. Again, we're supposed to believe that Maggie's going to do this. Here's what I believe. Maggie's like, I'm out of here. You know, kind of thing. Like, she'd be gone.
And she just does like DJ record scratching with the containment spells. Yeah, right, and it's just the most like, why is this how we're solving this problem?
Yeah.
Like who decided that was how this was going to get resolved? Come on.
Remember, folks, at the beginning of the episode, we mentioned that you're going to stay with you to the end and be like, oh, it falls apart at the end.
Yeah.
It's falling apart.
It's a big time fall apart there.
Throwing it out there. Disrupts the machine, releasing the ghost from its power. The ghost hurl Cyrus into the ring, slicing into bits.
Which that bit's kind of fun too.
Yeah,
the one shot of all the ghosts looking down at Cyrus when they grab him—that's really cool.
Yeah, it's very Day of the Dead. Rhodes. When the guy who's like, and he rips him apart and rip his vocal cords out and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Fun upbeat scene that is. where is it? So with the encouragement of Dennis's ghost, Arthur jumps into the machine, avoiding the rings and saving the children. The walls of the house shatter as a malfunctioning machine rips itself apart, freeing the ghost. Dennis smiles as Arthur and the children depart. Jean's ghost appears before the family and tells them she loves them before she and all the other ghosts appear. As the family leaves the house, Maggie exclaims that she is quitting. And they all walk off. That's the, like, I love that scene. They're all just storming off in the woods. Where are you going to go? I don't know. Let's just go.
Yeah, I really like the scene of all the ghosts just walking off and fading out one by one. It's really cool because it just gives you that vibe of like, I don't know, they're just going to go find other people to haunt.
What are we going
to
do? I don't know. We're all really ready to murder people, but I guess we could just go hang out.
Hope nobody lives anywhere near this house.
Yeah.
Which if they could have done like sequel stuff, they should have kept Dennis alive and they could have just had like 14 ghosts where he has to go get the ghost back or whatever.
Yeah,
that'd be fun.
Guess he gets a van and a dog.
He has four friends.
Yeah, jinkies. So when this movie opened, it opened number two, making a little over 15 million its opening weekend. It spent 10 weeks in the box office, making almost 42 million domestically, and just under 68.5 worldwide. Reviews were negative beyond belief for this movie.
Oh yeah.
But the problem was, as they said, okay, so reviews mostly negative. However, a cult following does exist, which is very true with everyone of these movies. Praise was directed towards production design, but the film was criticized for its lack of scares and number of the strobe effects that actually caused seizures, which was super fun. That actually happened. Yikes. Yeah. You know, like on Rotten Tomatoes, which is a thing I don't actually believe in, it has a 15%, and then a 3.4 out of 10 and stuff like that. But, like, again, for those of you who ever listen to me, I don't believe Rotten Tomatoes. Rotten Tomatoes is a joke. It's one of the biggest, like, pieces of bull out there going. But, you know, people like, take that as gospel. Like, oh, this movie has a high Rotten Tomatoes score, and you watch it. Like a movie, I don't know, like Hereditary, and it blows. I mean, just absolutely blows.
See, I love Hereditary.
Oh,
but...
well, I'm sorry. I hated it.
No, it's just, that's a different situation to litigate, but I totally agree with Rotten Tomatoes. Like, there's so many times, because Rotten Tomatoes is basically a measure of, will the average person like this movie? And that basically completely fails anytime you get into niche interests. Especially with horror and stuff, where there's like a very committed, specific community.
Yeah.
Because the average person doesn't like a lot of the stuff that you and I like, you know?
So, perfect example of this, movie like, okay, so and I'm pretty sure you enjoyed it, movie like Dread.
Love Dread.
Not Judge Dread, the original folks. Dread, the one that's actually, like, not the one that's tongue-in-cheek, the one where there's a lot of holes in cheeks. That movie has a horrible rating.
Ugh.
But it has a viewer score that's like 7.8 out of 10. It's like, everyone loves it. And I'm like, how is that? How can people who actually saw the movie love it, but all that, like, but it's going to be really bad? It's got like 30%. I'm like, because the movie's not for everybody. It's literally not for everybody. But anyone who went and saw it, Like, you did not go to Dread saying, I wonder what this is about. Like,
yeah, no, not at all.
I wish I was joking, and some of you have heard this before, but you know, bear with me, because it's worth telling. We went and saw 300 opening weekend, just a long time ago, because, you know, that's a long time ago. And in the movie, I'm sitting there with Kelly and my parents and stuff like that. We're watching this. And literally, I had read 300. My dad had read 300, you know, beforehand. But even if you hadn't, the poster might give away what the movie's about.
Yeah, so, you would think.
Right. So after the scene where Leonidas goes up and he meets with the elder, will this be successful? And there's all the
the oracle or whatever.
Right. And like the oracle, and like, but there's the women who are dancing, whatever. They're all the spirits and stuff. This woman who in front gets him goes, oh, I never, grabs her husband and drags him out, and the poor guy is just shoving in popcorn, going, oh my god, oh my god, and I go, what happened there? So movie ended. I said, you guys see that? And Kelly goes, yeah, I wonder what that was about. I go, what did she think the movie's about? Bowling? Like, what do you think 300 stood for? Like, literally, it does what it says on the outside. And that's the one thing about 13 Ghosts. If you went into this going, man, I really hope there's some great acting. No.
Yeah, no, not going to happen.
Did you not see Matthew Lillard's name on there? You know, kind of thing. Just
which
saying.
He's really good in it, but, yeah, you know.
But he's not a great actor. You know, kind of thing. I mean, and I'm not sure.
Yeah, with the exception of his work in Twin Peaks The Return, which he's, like, really good in. But otherwise,
but that's
way
later than this. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Especially early on in his career, he's not great. But in this, he's, like, the really strong part of it. Like, he's very charismatic in this.
I'm saying, and like, in Scream, you totally believe him of being a teenager being an idiot because he's a teenager and idiot, right? And what I'm saying is, like, but so if you really, like, what did you go in thinking you were going to get? I mean, like, Roger Ebert ripped it apart. He said the production was first rate and the physical look of the picture is splendid. But he said he criticized the story, lack of interesting characters, poor editing. I'm like, there's definitely things that can be tightened up here. That's what it is. It doesn't mean that the movie's horrible. It just means that it's just not on a par with some of the other films that could have been made around that time. Because, again, this is, 2001. So we're talking about, I mean, there were movies coming out in that time. I mean, again, not horror movies per se, but there were movies coming out like Gladiator, like, you know, things like, and again, I know Gladiator's, you know, can win the Academy Awards, but Gladiator's a B movie, for Christ's sake, you know, and it won the Academy Award, definitely. You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not impossible. And so it comes down to, you know, again, and I'm not trying to, you know, compare to say, you need to be Ridley Scott or you need to be whatever, like, you know? But I'm just saying, there's a reason why there's movies that came out that time that are really, really good because they took the time to edit. They took the time to whatever, and they didn't get bogged down. This has a lot of that early 2000s feel on it.
Yes. You know? And it really, it kind of infects the tone of the whole film so that even as you're watching, like, the, like I said before, the cinematography, the way that they do it is kind of jarring. Mm-hmm. Whereas I feel like the scares would be a lot more effective if the scares were the only time where the cinematography got that jarring.
Yeah. Because
if you pair that with like a kind of like a chill inducing soundtrack, that could really make those scares sing in a way that they really don't in this version of the movie.
Yeah. I mean, your cinematographer here, was the late, Gail, Tattersall. You know, she died, she's not dead. So she was not. But she had worked on The Commitments and Tank Girl, and actually did 120 episodes of House, the TV series. So again, it's not, they didn't just get nobody, but again, it's not like, but it just didn't work well here. And then your music, is John Fritzell. And that, hang on one sec, folks, we're getting a call. It's not, even though it's not a call-in show. So, all right, good. The secretary took care of it. No problem. we had that happen before. Dad and I were using it, and then the phone rang, and we said, hang on, folks, we got a call here. And then Luke was cut in asking a question, and then I answered said question, kind of thing, which is funny. And everyone's like, that's really cool. I'm like, yeah, we totally did that months later. and again, this guy, he was known for doing the film scores to I Still Know What You Did Last Summer, Alien Resurrection, Dante's Peak, Ghost Ship, Gods and Generals, The Reaping. He worked on The Following, the TV series and stuff like that. Again, it's not John Williams, but I think they tried to get somebody, and again, they keeping the cost down and things like that, part of what they were doing and giving young up and comers a chance. I don't have a problem with that. It's just I think sometimes you have to kind of like, look, we really need this.
Like, yeah.
Somebody has to have a clear vision of what's happening here. And I think what happened was you had some vision, but then you had somebody say, hey, let's change this up. Let's do this. And it's like,
Yeah, and with 13 Ghosts, like, whenever you have a fundamentally gimmick-driven story, your director has to be somebody who has a real specific take on that gimmick.
Yeah.
Because everything has to follow from the gimmick and strengthen the gimmick at the center of it. Or it becomes like this, where the ghosts are there and they're clear and they're interesting, but there's not really enough of them. There's not really anything specific about any of them. It feels like the story could have been written without knowing what the ghosts specifically were or what their characters were.
Right, right.
Because nobody even talks about the specific ghosts except for the Juggernaut.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those things where it's, if you had somebody starting from a place where they're saying like, okay, the main thing we're going to get across is these ghosts. Here are the ways we can accent and show these ghosts and have them featured. Like, if they treated this a little more like a creature feature, I think it would go a long way to helping it be better.
Yeah. And again, it's, I think a lot of that has to do when you look at a lot of Dark Castle movies, you run into that off more often than not, you know, kind of thing. Like, someone who clearly has a vision of what they're doing, and you say, well, Jay, it's hard to do. And I get it. I'm not saying it's perfect, but you need someone who has a clear vision of what they want to do, and this is where the movie we're making. And
absolutely,
which is why I think when Dad and I talked about Mad Max Fury Road earlier this year for Mother's Day, when you look at that movie, there's a very clear idea of what George Miller is doing, and he doesn't care what anyone else says, and that's why that movie is amazing. You know, kind of thing. You
really need a strong director behind a project like this.
Yeah. I mean, if you're making a rom-com, all right, great.
Yeah, whatever. You know, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't really matter. You're making a stupid comedy. You're making whatever, like, you know, something brainless or whatever. Okay. Right. I mean, you're going to go for gags anyway, kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
When you want to make a movie that hits home, and again, we're talking about, again, if you're not going to make a creature feature kind of thing, you want these ghosts to have some, you want people to feel bad for these ghosts.
Yeah.
You don't feel bad for the ghost. You don't know anything about
it. No, not at all.
Because you can't feel bad. You're like, well, okay, it's a little kid with an arrow in his head. Huh. All right, let's see who's next, you know, kind of thing. Like, it's like you don't have anything.
Yeah.
There's no way to feel bad. There's no way to have empathy there. The only one you feel empathetic for is the wife, and that's only because we know that she happens to be a ghost halfway through the story. You're like, all right. So, yeah.
Well, and it's a movie that feels like it has a lot going on, but it also feels like none of the elements are fleshed out enough.
Yeah.
And I don't really know how to solve that problem other than, I guess, make a longer movie. But this also probably wouldn't maintain if it was a 2-hour movie either.
No.
You know, so it's really confusing where I get why they would be overwhelmed and how they would kind of it's hard to wrangle because you have a lot of stuff going on, but you kind of just got to wrangle it. You just got to be a little bit better at doing that job, you know?
Yeah. It just didn't do it. It just, again, the movie sets up well. I think if your ending really popped, like, whoa, what a great ending, you'd remember the movie better. I think that hurts it and stuff. But
and it never really quite gets to, it never feels like it fulfills what it sets up.
Yeah. It's like we're getting close. It's like we're getting close to that 90-minute, guys. Let's start wrapping this thing up. It's like, you know, like, just kind of go with it. It'll be fine, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
It's too big to be human. Just send 4 kids down. You know, kind of, you know. A lot of Family Guy references tonight. It's okay. But overall, it's, you know, I didn't mind going back and rewatching this movie. I picked up the Blu-ray. Unfortunately, the Blu-ray comes with House of Wax, not Ghost Ship. But you know, for $7, I was like, all right, I guess I'll have it. You know, kind of thing.
Yeah, if it was with Ghost Ship, I'd be a lot prouder to own it.
Yeah. Well, I look at it this way. It's like when I bought the 1933's King Kong on Blu-ray.
Mm.
It comes in a it comes with 10,000 BC or whatever the heck it was, that movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's okay, but nothing special. It comes with Cloverfield. Okay. And then it comes with Jack the Giant Slayer. And I'm like, that's not so great. But I look at how much King Kong cost by itself, and I'm like, that's like $30. Or I can buy them all together for $8, and they're all separate discs. Mm-hmm. I was like, how does that make any sense? But I'll do that anyway.
So yeah,
I got
as well.
Three movies for free, basically, and got King Kong for $8. To buy this movie by itself was going to run me like $30, and I'm like, no thank you.
Yeah, no.
But at $7 or $8 used on Amazon, I'm like, I can live with the fact it came with the other movie. You know,
yeah, it's worth it. Yeah. It's worth it.
The shame is if it came with Ghost Ship, I'm like, and sold?
You know? Yeah, absolutely. So.
But
yeah, Ghost Ship is a lot of fun.
Yeah. So, folks, you know, what do you think? I mean, have you got, did you, again, I know we talked about 13 Ghosts. We actually had someone wrote in about, not about 13 Ghosts, but about gimmicks being used in general. And I actually talked to my dad about that on that previous episode. And the idea being is like, you know, here the gimmick wasn't like the viewer. The gimmick was in the movie. They worked it in. But if you had never seen the original 13 Ghosts, you could watch this and not have to be like, oh, I don't understand what's happening because I didn't see the original. It kind of stands on its own and makes its own thing. I think they tried really hard to kind of capture the spirit of what William Castle would do. But I think they kind of missed the point sometimes. We talked about this. William Castle really was making like, you know, his movies, and again, as silly as the script might be or the effects might look or whatever, they, you know, like the concept of what you're talking about, his scripts were always well-paced and like they did. I mean, even his lesser films are still really well-paced and good. Even if you're like, oh boy, though, that's a skeleton on a wire, or the, hey, that doesn't look scary. Like, that's not what he's going for, you know?
So. They need somebody with formalist storytelling sensibilities, formalist cinematography sensibilities, and then just somebody who also loves the kind of like I've been saying, that weird like Scooby-Doo style gimmick driven monster vibe. Because if you get that, if you have somebody who loves that and who can write a good script, like you have 13 Ghosts.
Yep.
And you could make a really interesting 13 Ghosts movie with those elements that is better than this one.
Yeah. So, but again, folks, you know, if you've seen this and you like this, because maybe you're the right age, maybe you're like me and you were, you know, either right, you're in college or right out of college. This case happened, came out after I was out of college. Or maybe you're younger like you, you know, kind of thing. You saw it. And again, 2001. So, you know.
Yeah, I watched this first on Sci-Fi Channel, I believe. Right. And I was like, oh, this is pretty good.
Yeah. So I'm saying it's like, so it's definitely one of those things like you could say like, oh, okay. Like this has, you know, have you seen this? Did you like it? Did you not like it? Did you try to take a date to it, hoping you're going to get scared? And you were like, oh, okay. You know, I'm just saying. You know, kind of thing. The 2000s were not great. Like, let's go to a movie. Let's try to get my girl scared. She jumps at me like in the 80s. And I'm like, eh, don't work like that no more, buddy. You know, nowadays it's just like you're bored. Anything that's supposed to be super scary, it's like super boring. You know, and the movies that are actually worth watching, like Crawl, you know, kind of thing, which I took Haley and Kelly to go see, you know, back when that was out. And it's not scary, scary, but it's like, they were like, ha ha, they're jumping. I'm like, well, that at least was fun. You know,
yeah, sure. I'm always down for a, like, people trapped with a dangerous animal or monster movie. Like, those are always, I'm always going to enjoy those.
Yeah. So, I'm saying this. So, I mean, you know, it's hard. But, all right, folks. So, again, if you've seen this, you want to write in about, let us know. And, again, any feedback that you want to give to me, I'll share with Jonathan. And, we'll get back together and talk about it. Maybe we'll just, you know, if need be, we can do a special, like, quick segment answering it. And I can cut it into an episode or something. Or
oh, sure, yeah.
Next
That'd
time
be great.
You're on, we can answer that. Or I can next time I have you on, because I don't going to have you back.
Oh, yeah.
We don't know what yet, folks. So don't be like, oh, what movie? We don't know yet. We didn't get that far.
we'll figure it out.
Right, trust me. Like, we got to figure this out. Like, we hammered out a bunch of movies at one time, and then we covered all those. I'm like, we need a new list. And, you know, the nice part is we'll cover it, and we'll talk about that. So if you got something to say. John, why don't you tell everyone where they can find you on the internet?
Yeah, so basically, I have a podcast called X Meets Y. You can find that at xmeetsy.libsyn.com. That's kind of my flagship thing that I've got going. It's basically a movie pitch improv podcast. So every episode, we select two movie titles out of a hat and then have half an hour to combine them into a totally new, totally original movie idea. Jason has been on the show before. We'll make it work and have him on again because I really want to have him back. And it is a really fun, kinetic, weird little, kind of bite-sized podcast. And I really enjoy doing it.
Yep. Hey folks, I listen to it all the time. If it was me, I think I would start with the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids Predator episode. That's just cause I'm on that one. And that's a really good one though. I'm telling you, other people who listen to it, they go, wow, Jay, you guys developed an entire story, like literally the entire movie. I go, we had everything. You know, kind of
we tear through that.
All fell into place. It's like
it's so much fun. That episode is so good.
Yeah, it's what the writers of 13 Ghosts wish happened when they sat down to write their movie. So
instead of some producer sitting in the room and being like, but what if the housekeeper, uses the containment spells like it's a turntable?
Right.
Yeah. And they're like, I guess we can put that in.
Sure, why not? We have everything else.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're the one paying.
Yeah, like, so that's what you want in your movie. So, yeah, like I said, folks, so go check out X Meets Y. It's a great podcast. Again, like they said, he said they're bite-sized, so you know, they're half an hour, kind of like they're, you know, they run like 35 minutes. Most of them are around that time with the intro and the outro and stuff like that. Super fun. Great ideas. It's stuff you're like, oh, okay. Understand this. I said this before. At times you'll agree with what they're saying. At times you'll yell at your radio or your radio.
Definitely.
You'll yell at your thing, your podcast.
Your podcast
machine.
Catcher.
Yeah. You'll yell at it. Go, don't go that way. You know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, don't do that. You know? And again, you know, when you listen to those, you love getting feedback too. So,
oh yes.
Hit them up with feedback. Hey, let's do this. And it's just, it's, I'll put it this way. You know, on here, we talk about movies that exist and how we might make change it better. This is taking two things that exist and like, how do we make, it's like the first person who put the chocolate and the peanut butter together, you know,
like
they put other things together first. And they're like, I don't know about that one. It's like the first person who figured out you could smoke tobacco. Right? What are they walking around? Pine cones? Oh, that's smooth. Like, what are they doing? Like, seriously, like, I'm just wondering. So, and I'm not advocating that anyone smoke a pine cone.
Yes.
Don't
do that. Smoking is bad for you in general, but especially if it's pine cones.
Especially pine cones. Don't do it. Little letter. You told me to smoke a pine cone. I feel like, oh, God.
Yes, this has been a secret PSA against smoking pine cones the entire episode.
So don't smoke pine cones.
So, don't do it. It's not fun.
It's like WE because don't try this at home. And my daughter always says, go to a friend's house. Because I always say that too. And I was like, would you go to a freaking friend's house already? You know, kind of thing. So
that's funny.
Anyway, folks, we're getting a little far afield. So thank you very much for coming on today, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me.
Great time talking about 13 Ghosts, a movie I hadn't seen uncut. Again, I've seen on Sci-Fi Channel and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen this movie in a number of years uncut. It was nice to go back and look at it. We got some great killer effects in the movie. You know, the writing and everything else, whatever, but the effects were really good. And I think they showed a lot of what they could have done. And I think this is probably a perfect kind of like encapsulation of what Dark Castle is as a studio, right? You know, some things are really good. Some things, you know, kind of falls apart at the end and, you know, so.
But. Yeah, it doesn't really hold together, but it's a fun watch when you know what you're getting.
Yep. All right, folks. So, again, like I said, folks, if you got anything, hit us up, let us know. Any feedback for Jonathan, I'll share with him, and we'll have him back on. Keep those cards and letters coming, and keep watching the skies.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters? Or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at Two True Freaks. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at BotsBugsBabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Giaconetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots Bugs Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Giaconetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc. are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!
Will you stop?